Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A very, very important facet of that war at the moment, of course, is the struggle now underway in several quarters involving the efforts that have been made for some time to prevent Iran from realizing its long-standing ambitions to obtain nuclear weapons. Joining us to discuss the so-called framework agreement that the Obama administration claims to have achieved with the Iranians, and more to the point, claims have sealed off all of the paths that the Iranians might pursue to getting nuclear weapons, is Henry Sokolsky, a man I've had the privilege of knowing and working with for a long time. Today, he is the executive director of the Nonproliferation Policy Education Center, has been an adjunct professor at the Institute of World Politics for some time, formerly worked in the Pentagon in the office of the Secretary of Defense, where he was the deputy for nonproliferation policy, and also a military legislative aide to an old friend, Senator Dan Quayle. Henry Sokolsky, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us, sir.
Good to be back.
You have been following very closely for a long time the to-ing and fro-ing, as it were, about negotiating with the Iranians under this administration, under previous administrations. You spoke about all of these issues at the Heritage Foundation last week. Give us sort of an overall assessment of what the administration has wrought so far and where this is likely to leave Iran's nuclear capabilities.
Well, the administration has struck a preliminary understanding. It's not clear whether both sides agree to every one of the specifics, but roughly, the Iranians will operate a smaller number of centrifuges than they might otherwise operate because they have a larger number ready to go. And the hope is that if they only operate these roughly 5,000 centrifuges, they won't be able to get a bomb's worth of highly enriched uranium in anything less than roughly a year. There are a number of scenarios where that doesn't quite work out at all, but there are a number of scenarios where it does. And then the general argument is that they're going to rearrange a smaller reactor called Arak, A-R-A-K, so that it doesn't produce as much plutonium, and that we might have some timely warning of a diversion of the bomb's worth there. And the idea is that you keep them under these restraints for about 10 to 15 years. There are some other things that go a little bit longer. And that by that time, Iran becomes a friendlier country that you can trust. And then you just have normal restraints like the kind you'd have on, let's say, a Japan that currently enriches and reprocesses as much material as it wants, but you have occasional inspections. I mean, I think that's roughly it.
That's roughly the plan or the aspiration, as it were. In the Wall Street Journal last week, you were quoted as expressing very serious concerns about one of the alternative scenarios that seems readily at hand and that would make a complete mockery of this whole arrangement. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, one of the easiest, quickest ways to get a large number of weapons usable and even weapons-grade plutonium would be to take the spent fuel from their large power reactor. It's much, much bigger reactor than this reactor they're reconfiguring. At Iraq, it's a 1 gigawatt machine, and it can make, I don't know, at any given time, you could get access to 20 to 60 bombs worth of material. The only thing that you need is a chemical separation line, which could fit in a warehouse. I mean, I don't know, 30 by 60 by 120 feet. It's not a big thing. And you can build this thing for very little money, keep it from being known because it puts off no signal. And it would then, once you got it operating, it would take a week, you would then make a bomb's worth a day. Now, to give you some idea, the argument is, oh, well, they have a ban on reprocessing. By the way, one of the neat features of whatever's been agreed to so far is that we might have gotten them to say that they're not going to reprocess. I kind of like that aspect of the deal, by the way. But the problem is verifying it means you have to be able to enter every warehouse, God knows, in all of Iran. That might be very tricky. Now, what that highlights is our kind of willful inattention to possibilities, I would argue, not only in Iran, but everywhere else as well. Yet there is a fix, and it isn't much. And what's astonishing is that we've asked, and they've never said yes to it, and that is just to have more frequent remote and on-site inspection checks, which can be done at a very low expense, and they have said no to this. And it's bothersome because about 2 years ago, they took all the spent fuel out, and there was about 20-some-odd bombs worth of weapons-grade material in that spent fuel, and there were no inspectors there. And we had to swarm the area with drones. The CIA did that. We know that because the Iranians complained to the UN that we violated their airspace. This tells you that we're not quite as serious about all of this as we need to be, I think.
That is an understatement of epic proportions. Our guest is Henry Sokolsky. He is the executive director of the Nonproliferation Policy Education Center in Washington, D.C., a go-to resource for those trying to make sense of things like this Iranian deal. So, Henry, you've put down a couple of markers here. We're not sure what's been agreed, really. We're not sure how the scenarios will play out if the sort of best case of what's been agreed, that being represented by the Obama administration, actually materializes. You've talked about an end around that isn't even under discussion in this deal, namely just simply using the vast output of the Bushehr nuclear power plant. You mentioned this business about verification, and I just want to spend a minute more on that. The administration has said they've got the most comprehensive and unprecedentedly intrusive inspections as associated with this. Is there any evidence of that either?
Well, actually, I'll give them half credit for that. And I think a lot of people who are bearish on this deal tend to get very excited when they hear that. Say, that's not true. Unfortunately, it tells us more about how uncomprehensive most of the controls are on places like Japan and Korea and other places. It doesn't tell us how comprehensive the inspections are per se in Iran going to be. In other words, we have relatively lax inspections, I would argue, particularly over what are called fuel-making plants, like enrichment and reprocessing. And yes, they're more comprehensive than what's in place, but that tells you the problem is we need something tougher everywhere else.
It's a low bar. But Henry, let me ask you this. You're one of the keepers of the flame on the whole nonproliferation agenda. And over the years, probably you've been as effective as anybody in arguing about the importance of protecting the nuclear nonproliferation treaty. It certainly seems to me, based on what we've seen coming forward in this framework agreement, as though Iran is being allowed to renegotiate the terms of the so-called NPT in a way that, if replicated by any other nation, would essentially eviscerate it. Is that likely? And more generally, do you think that the upshot of all of this is going to be not only nuclear weapons in Iran, but in a whole host of other countries in the region and perhaps beyond as well?
Well, you've asked the most important question. People jump to the assumption that, and not unreasonably, I might add, that well, this becomes the model and everybody gets right up to the brink of getting bombs. Now, that's a bad outcome, and you really don't want that to happen. If there is a deal, by the way, it's not clear they're going to be able to pull this off, but if there is a deal, you really want to make two points clear. This is a bad situation that has been mitigated a little, and we do not want to repeat this anywhere else. And if anything, we need to toughen up all the other rules everywhere else so that when 10 years runs out and they say, well, now we should be treated like everyone else is now treated with tougher rules. Whether or not we do that, And whether or not we actually care about the NPT enough to see that that's necessary, jury definitely is out on that.
Henry Sokolsky, we appreciate your insights and the work that you do at the Nonproliferation Policy Education Center. I hope that we'll have a chance to take stock with you on this as it further develops in the days ahead. Next up, we'll take stock with the former commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, Admiral Ace Lyons, about the threat emerging from both Iran and China. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitz for the Center for Security Policy. Over the last week, it has become clear that the so-called framework agreement announced by the Obama administration to bring about a comprehensive nuclear deal with Iran is in deep trouble. Iranian officials have disagreed with the Obama administration's account of the framework, especially over verification and sanctions relief. Contrary to U.S. claims that there will be strict verification and phased sanctions relief, Iranian leaders have said verification efforts will be limited, with military facilities off limits. They also insist that sanctions must be completely terminated, not suspended, once a final agreement is signed. So if there was not agreement on the framework, what's going on here? The likely explanation is that the framework is a fraud to stop Congress from passing legislation imposing new sanctions on Iran or requiring a congressional vote on a final nuclear agreement. It is my hope Congress will not be fooled by this obvious fraud. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by one of the men I've come to admire most, particularly, but not exclusively, for his distinguished service in uniform, which was capped by a tenure as the Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, the largest single military command in the world. He served in a number of other capacities, including as the Deputy Chief of Naval Operations and a number of other command positions. Today, he is the President and CEO of Lyons Associate, and as far as I'm concerned, of particular importance, the Chairman of the Center for Security Policy's Military Committee. He is, of course, Admiral James Ace Lyons. Admiral Lyons, welcome back, sir. It is always a privilege to have you with us.
Nice to be with you, Frank.
You are, of course, deeply knowledgeable about so many different topics. It's hard to think through what we can most efficiently address with you. But I think I might pick up, Admiral, on some of the points that I was just discussing in the previous segment with Henry Sokolsky, namely about this so-called deal with Iran. Maybe just for starters, what is your assessment of the nature of the deal and its likely implications?
Well, I see what we've done is we've solidified Iran's objective of becoming a nuclear weapon capable country. None of the principal core elements of their nuclear weapons infrastructure is touched. It all remains in place. So it's far in excess what they require for, they say, peaceful purposes. And I got to tell you and your listeners, Frank, when you're proven oil reserves conservatively are estimated to last for over 250 years, why do we need nuclear power as an alternative energy source? Makes absolutely no sense.
It doesn't, and it does actually raise suspicions about the true purpose, which, of course, is your point. We're visiting with Admiral James Ace Lyons, the former Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, now the President and CEO of Lyons Associates, also the Chairman of the Center for Security Policy's Military Committee. And Admiral, I think your observation about the effects of this so-called deal, and I don't know whether to even dignify it by calling it a deal, given the loose nature of what's been agreed here, but it does seem as though Iran will have no serious impediment now to pursuing its nuclear weapons ambitions. In fact, they seem to think that they've been green-lighted and legitimated in pursuing them. But your assessment as a man who has long contended with the military implications of an Iran, even one without nuclear weapons, is that these guys are now going to represent a vastly more serious threat to us? Is that fair?
There's no question about it, Frank. Your listeners need to reflect on the fact that Iran's been at war with the United States for over 35 years. It caused the loss of thousands of American lives, and your listeners should never forget it was Iran who provided the key material and training support to the 9/11 hijackers that cost the lives of 3,000 innocent Americans on the worst terrorist threat against the United States. Those 3,000 Americans were doing nothing more than going to work. And to think, even when Iran had, in a death struggle with Iraq, they still conducted acts of war against the United States. It makes absolutely no sense. And to think that suddenly now they're going to become a responsible member of the international community and known as the leading state sponsor of terrorism is pure nonsense.
Admiral, I want to get your thoughts on one particular facet of this emerging deal. According to the Wall Street Journal last week, President Obama has, again, it seems, compounded the concessions he has been making to get this so-called framework agreement en route to some kind of final comprehensive arrangement with Iran in 2 months' time by saying that while sanctions, some sanctions at least, may remain in place for a time, something the Iranians refuse to say they will accept, but he is prepared to give them something between $30 and $50 billion just for signing on to this agreement. In your military and professional assessment, Admiral Lyons, what kinds of capabilities, what kinds of additional danger might be posed to the United States and its interests and its allies should Iran get that kind of windfall infusion into their economy?
Well, you know exactly where it's going to go, Frank. It's not going to go to the man in the street in Iran. It's going to support all their terrorist operations throughout the world. It's going to support Hamas and Hezbollah. It's going to support the illegal regime in Syria, the continued upheavals in Yemen. It's going to continue to work against our national interests and those of our allies. It's certainly going to threaten our allies in the Persian Gulf region.
I fear you're right, and it's just another reason why this deal, I believe, should be rejected by the United States Congress. Admiral Lyons, let me turn to another area, of course, very much a focus for your professional time, especially as the commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, but throughout your military career, namely the Western Pacific. There was a report that was released in the past week or two from the Naval Intelligence Service, the Office of Naval Intelligence, indicating that the Chinese are now building something on the order of 60 ships, warships, per year. Would you talk a little bit about what the implications are of that kind of buildup in terms not just really of the quantity of these vessels, but also your assessment of their quality and therefore what they might pose in the way of a threat to American forces, shipping, and interests in the region?
Well, let's face it, Frank. They've been on a double-digit military buildup for over the last decade. They have built a Navy to confront the United States Navy. The fact that this latest report says they're building over 60 ships a year, when we here in the United States Navy, we're building something on the order of 10 or 12 ships a year. And let me tell your listeners, Frank, I had more ships in the Pacific Fleet under my command than we have in the entire United States Navy today. Clearly, what China is doing is they are building the base to ensure hegemony over the Western Pacific, weaken our alliance with our allies, and it will go well beyond the Western Pacific, because I see it also in expanding into the Indian Ocean and into the Middle East. We should not forget it's actually China that runs the container port in Aden and Yemen.
And also container ports on both sides of the Panama Canal and in Caribbean ports, and unfortunately now I think increasingly in Asia. This is truly a blue water navy that they're building, and its ambitions to exercise power, influence events, project their interests throughout the world, I'm afraid, is the shape of things to come. Admiral Lyons, your service to our country in dealing with past threats has been of incalculable importance and is deeply appreciated by all of us, as is your continuing service to our country, including your terrific pieces at the Washington Times, and of course your work with the Center for Security Policy's Military Committee, notably in connection with our Secure Freedom Strategy. Thank you, sir, for all of this. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll be talking more about this Chinese buildup and its implications with Gordon Chang. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're all part of your community.
We all play a role in keeping our community safe.
So protect your everyday.
If you see something suspicious, say something to local authorities.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Effney with the Secure Freedom Minute. If you thought the magnitude of Team Obama's abject capitulation to Iran on the latter's nuclear weapons program could not be exceeded. Think again. Caught in the lie that the Iranians had agreed to a conditional and phased relaxation of sanctions as the price for limited restrictions on their pursuit of the bomb, the administration has reportedly agreed to an enormous new concession. If Iran now agrees that some sanctions would remain in place, the U.S. would immediately repatriate as much as $50 billion in Tehran's frozen assets. The mullahs can buy a lot of terrorism, subversion, regional hegemony, and nuclear weapons for $50 billion. Moreover, some experts believe that this shot in the arm for Iran's economy would negate the leverage of any remaining economic sanctions. Congress must dump this deal. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. It's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. No matter what happens, if it matters to you and you listen long enough, you'll learn what it means and different ways to think about it. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
This is Frank Affney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Affney.
We're back, joined, as I'm very pleased to say, we have the privilege of being each week by Gordon Chang. You find his outstanding columns at Forbes.com and WorldAffairsJournal.com. Also, you'll see him frequently at Fox News and in other media outlets. He is indeed one of our country's preeminent experts and go-to guys on matters involving Asia. His books on North Korea taking on the world and China and its coming collapse are required reading in this space. Gordon, as always, it's great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you so much, Frank. I mean, I think you were too kind, but I'm not going to argue.
Yeah, let me insist. Gordon, we were talking earlier in the program with Admiral Ace Lyons about what is happening militarily in the Western Pacific, and specifically I was probing him on what he makes of the implications of a rather extraordinary buildup that seems to be in evidence now on China's part with respect to its naval forces. You and I have been talking about this for a while, but this is now beginning to manifest itself in ways that are clearly causing neighbors like India concern, as well as the Japanese. Talk a bit, if you would, about the prospect that China's now rather considerable naval presence and power projection capabilities will change the sort of strategic environment in the Western Pacific.
Well, China is building up its armed forces, but especially its navy, its undersea forces, the submarines are increasing at a rapid pace, and not only in number, but also in capability. We have the beginning of nuclear deterrence patrols on the part of the Chinese, but we also have the development of weapons that can only be considered offensive in nature, such as their anti-ship cruise missiles, some of which are supersonic. The United States really has no defense for those, and so this is perhaps maybe not a game changer, but extremely close to it. Clearly, at this point, the United States and countries around the region, from India to Japan to Indonesia, Philippines, Vietnam, they all are concerned about the trajectory of what China is doing.
Are we adequately concerned about the trajectory of what China is doing, as you put it? Some 60 hulls under construction at the moment would, in short order, outstrip not only our production of naval warships, but the entire inventory of U.S. Navy ships. And as Rick Fisher described with us last week, these are not just numerically impressive activities, but the quality of such platforms seems to be very, very ominous as well.
The concern in the United States is there, but it's not nearly at the level that it needs to be. You know, right now, I think that there is a growing appreciation of not only the buildup in the Chinese military, but also the intentions of Chinese leaders. And this is only new. We should have been thinking about this decades ago, because the Chinese were doing things in the region that were troubling its neighbors, and we were sloughing this off. You know, at this point, I think that we are too far behind the game, and we got to understand that the Chinese will have not only superior forces in the Asia-Pacific region, but they will have a navy that probably will be larger than ours in all fronts, considering both surface and submarine combatants. So clearly this is something that the United States has not been adequately alarmed about.
Yeah. And I think it's fair to say, Gordon, that the projection of power by that formidable naval capability will not be confined to the Western Pacific. I mentioned India. Talk, if you would, a little bit about some thinking you've been doing about the need the Indians see for submarines and where they are likely to have that need met.
The Indians have a much better appreciation for the submarine threat that China poses in the Indian Ocean and elsewhere. They are now going in the process of tendering for submarines. They're going about it probably a little bit too slowly because they have a make or buy in India program that is really slowing down their ability to acquire submarines. Their yards building submarines are just not good enough. And I think that essentially the Modi government needs to go back to what the previous government was thinking of doing, and that is just buying submarines off the shelf from others. And they should be looking at Japan, because Japan, the Soryu class, which Australia will be acquiring soon, is really very silent, very deadly, and I think is probably adaptable to Indian weapons, though there do need to be some adjustments. The thing about China in the Indian Ocean is not just that it's flooding and surging its vessels into that body of water, but it's also building facilities that look like military bases. And one of those is at Walvis Bay in the South Atlantic, just at where this Atlantic meets the Indian Ocean. This it not only threatens India, but it also threatens the United States, because we're talking about the shipping on our eastern seaboard will become within range of China's vessels and perhaps its aircraft in the not-too-distant future.
Gordon Chang is our guest. You find his writings at Forbes and the World Affairs Journal, and also in book-length form in Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World and the Coming Collapse of China. Gordon, what I'm interested in is some of the thinking that you've been doing, and clearly the Indians have been doing, about how to both compete with and deal with China. Beyond the naval considerations that you've just described, what is the state of Indian and Chinese relations at the moment more broadly?
Right now, India is looking east, which is its policy it's had since the 1990s. But now it's starting to move towards an Act East policy, which is much more assertive, trying to build relations with countries not only around the South China Sea, but also the East China Sea. And this has really been in response to the Chinese looking at the Indian Ocean as theirs. So we have both India and China competing on a much broader stage right now, and the Indians are concerned about Chinese intentions in a way that we should have been concerned decades ago. Right now, India is looking at what it can do to build friends in a very big region, stretching from Africa on one side to Japan and South Korea on the other. So it shows increasing ambitions and a willingness to defend itself.
Yeah. Gordon, let me just conclude by asking you, against the backdrop of this military buildup and clearly a very aggressively expansionistic sort of policy more broadly on the part of the Chinese, you continue to see evidence that their economy is in serious trouble. Indeed, you've written about the death rattle of the Chinese economy. Talk about where you see that at the moment and how it might bear on these other strategic considerations.
China's National Bureau of Statistics reported that growth in the first quarter of this year was 7.0%. But the economy may actually have been contracting when we look at electricity, which was down 0.1%, trade down 6.0%, and construction starts down 18.4%. But the most important thing is the decline in foreign exchange reserves, which was an astounding $113 billion in the first quarter. I'm concerned that as Chinese generals and admirals and political leaders see a narrowing window for them, that they could very well lash out because their economy will not be able to support their ambitions, including their military ambitions, at least in the long run. And so we have to be worried that they will decide to act now while they still have the initiative.
We're just out of curiosity, Gordon, do you think that all those billions of dollars in foreign currency reserves went? Is this in some form or fashion tied up with one of the other things we talk about frequently, namely China's play for a reserve currency, or is this capital flight, or what's going on?
Well, there certainly is capital outflow, and much of it is indeed capital flight. Right now, China's foreign currency reserves, you know, mostly in dollars, but they've got a lot in euros, which means that they're sustaining losses. And also, they've used their reserves to make investments. And some of those investments are not paying off. So I don't think that they actually have the $3.7 trillion that they claim in ready assets. China is in much weaker condition than most people suspect, and this is going to affect the way Chinese leaders are acting. Right now, they appear to be panicking with their moves to flood the economy with liquidity, as we saw a couple days ago when the central bank reduced what's known as the reserve requirement ratio, releasing about $200 billion into the Chinese economy. That's a sign of desperation.
Yeah. Panic is not generally a good thing, especially if you are in fact feeling that this may be the closing window for you to lash out and perhaps prop up your regime through the social engineering technique of claiming foreign threats that justify your repression at home. Gordon Chang, as always, your insights are deeply appreciated. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. In the meantime, keep it up at Forbes, Fox, and World Affairs Journal. Talk with you soon. Next up, Nick Adams. We're going to talk with him about what's going on down under and the lessons of Australia's immigration policies for ours. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGT. SullivanCenter.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the global jihad movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined for the first time, I believe, by Nick Adams, a man I've come to know a bit and greatly admire. He hails from Down Under in Australia. He is an author, a columnist, and a commentator. With periodic visits to the United States, including the one he is on at the moment, he brings great insight into both what we can learn from the Australians and what we best understand about our own circumstance. His book is The American Boomerang, How the World's Greatest Turnaround Nation Will Do It Again.
Nick Adams, welcome. It's great to have you with us, sir.
G'day, Frank Gaffney. What an absolute pleasure and privilege it is to be here on air with you today.
Well, it's, for both of us, it is truly mutual. So, Nick, you have been spending a lot of time thinking about and writing about, and for that matter, warning about immigration policies, particularly those that your government used to follow and those that our government is following at the moment. Let's talk a little bit about a turnaround nation of a sort in terms of a very dramatic sea change that has taken place, as I understand it, in Australia, and what it has signaled both for your country and I think for ours as well.
Well, Frank, it's an excellent question. Look, Australia had a problem with illegal immigration. It doesn't anymore. In the last 12 months, we have not had one single illegal immigrant arrive on Australian soil. Not one single boat has docked on the Australian coastline because, of course, as your listeners would know, Australia is surrounded by water. So the only way to get to us illegally is obviously going to be by boat. Here's the kicker. The preceding 4 years, we saw 50,000 illegal immigrants arrive on Australian soil, more than 800 boats, upwards of 1,000 people drowned at sea. Our budget, the federal budget, blew out by more than $10.3 billion. It was an absolute disaster. Those that arrived were, of course, under a left-wing or democratic equivalent administration. They were given frank welcome hampers, mobile phones, plasma television, housing, medical, all at the cost of the taxpayer. And the overwhelming majority of those that came weren't genuine refugees. Many of them turned up in designer clothes and with mobile phones. They weren't fleeing persecution, Frank. They just wanted a piece of Australia's generous welfare state. Frighteningly, some of them appeared to be Western haters. You know, with one incident in particular that was captured on video by the Australian military when a boat was intercepted and the military were abused and told that you should remember September 11 to the United States, which was a threat to Australia.
Yeah. So, Nick, you have undergone this rather dramatic change. What was it that caused it? Was it a change of government? Was it obviously some changes in governmental policies? But was it fundamentally the revulsion of the people of Australia for this? And what ensued as that happened?
Yes, Frank, that's right. So the Australian people got really fed up with this situation. And a new Conservative government was elected. And this Conservative government pledged to stop the boats and end this absolute disastrous set of circumstances. Now, how did they do this? Well, obviously, they couldn't just wave the magic wand and stop the boats and not have anyone come. So for the first little while, Frank, what they did was, or what the Australian Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, came out and said, he said, okay, if you come to Australia illegally, you will never, ever get to stay. You will never, ever get to be an Australian. We don't want you. You have two options. We will either send you home and put you on a plane and we'll pay for it, or we will send you to a offshore processing centre, a little island off Australia, where you will be in indefinite detention until which time we have had an opportunity to assess your application. The word pretty quickly got out, Frank, that you will have risked a whole amount for absolutely no gain. Now, this policy that the Conservative government pursued thoroughly, there were no exceptions, not for children, not for anybody. This was tough love that was administered by the government of Australia, and eventually the word has gotten out that, you know, if you come to Australia, you're not going to get to stay. You're either going to wind up in detention or they're going to send you home. So we're not going to risk our lives to make this perilous journey.
So, Nick, this is a remarkable story. Of course, we find ourselves in a somewhat different situation in that we have long land borders with nations that have essentially encouraged immigration, or at least not discouraged it. most especially to our south. What do you recommend, based on the experience of your native Australia, for America at a moment when, if anything, the president of the United States is sort of pursuing the precedent Australian policy on steroids?
Well, that's exactly right, Frank. You know, President Obama has recently had occasion to hail Australia in terms of its gun laws, in terms of its compulsory voting, but he has not been praising it for what he really needs to praise it for, or base his immigration solution on the Australian model. Look, President Obama needs to button up. He needs to begin defending leadership in America and abroad. He needs to say, we will determine who comes into this country and the circumstances under which they come. He needs to say, if you come to America illegally, you will never get to stay, you will never be an American, we will send you home, period. Illegals should be aware that they will have risked plenty and spent a lot for zero result. I think he needs to get the National Guard down there, Frank, to do its job. He needs to demand that Mexico police its own border, and if not, maybe even threaten them with trade sanctions. I mean, that's what a real leader would do.
And it's what we're not finding in the present incumbent in the White House. Again, our guest is Nick Adams. He is from Australia. He's an author and columnist and commentator there. He's also a policy fellow at the Centennial Institute, a marvelous institution in Colorado. He is also the author of a best-selling book, The American Boomerang, How the World's Greatest Turnaround Nation Will Do It Again. And let me just ask you quickly, Nick Adams, given what you've seen in your own country and given what your study of these kinds of, well, daft immigration policies represent to freedom-loving nations, notably ours, what do you believe will be the consequence if the United States persists in these sort of policies, the executive amnesty the president has engaged in, bringing refugees here by the hundreds of thousands, including, as you say, some who are quite hostile to us, and we cannot vet whether they are jihadists out of Somalia or refugee camps in Syria, for example?
Look, it's very frightening, Frank, without a shadow of a doubt, and the president's executive amnesty will change America forever. It will change the dynamic of the people that live here. It will change those values and virtues that we consider to be quintessentially American. You can expect a different country. You know, the populations are on the move everywhere. Borders are under attack. Western countries' borders are under attack everywhere. And it's time for honesty from the left. How many millions do we really want, and how will they change this country? That's the question.
It is the question, and it is one that we will continue struggling with, I'm sure, for the foreseeable future. Nick Adams, your insights and your clarity on these issues is a breath of fresh air. I hope that your trip home is safe and that you will be back here soon. In the meantime, keep up the tremendous work you're doing down under and, of course, at the Centennial Institute. And thank you for taking the time to join us. Thank you all for joining us as well. I hope you'll do so again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.